Hello and welcome to Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP membership communities and engagement team. I'm Alice, and to celebrate RCGP Pride season and the launch of our online exhibition, Women at the Heart of General Practice, we will be exploring some exhibition themes in context of women GPs from the LGBT plus community. Women at the Heart of General Practice uncovers the history and present day experiences of women in medicine and in general practice. The exhibition is split into 8 themes, which you can discover in full on the RCGP website. But today, we will be discussing 4 themes: women as patients, women GPs at work, leadership roles, and the family unit. One of the reasons for recording this podcast is that while the exhibition goes into some depth looking at women's experience as a whole, there are still hidden voices within those stories, one of which being LGBT plus women. I'm delighted to have with me 3 GPs who'll be sharing their lived perspectives on some of these topics. If you could briefly introduce yourselves and your remit.
My name's Chloe and I'm currently a academic F2 in Bristol, and I aspire to be a GP when the time comes next year. So I graduated from Cambridge in 2020, so as part of the COVID cohort, and made a cross-country move to settle into my new life in Bristol.
Hi, my name's Martha. I'm currently a GP ST2 based in North East London. I graduated some time back in 2014. I've kind of been dabbling around in a bit of emergency medicine before settling on GP as a career. And I look forward to the podcast with you all today.
Hi, I'm Ali. I'm a GP in Greater Manchester. I've been a GP here now, GP partner, for 14 years. I'm the current Northwest faculty chair, and my other main GP role is clinical director for primary care workforce for Greater Manchester. And I also dabble, and my colleagues will not like this, but I also work as an associate medical director at a local hospital looking at leadership and workforce opportunity.
Thanks, Chloe, Martha and Ali, for joining me. Kicking off our discussion with women as patients, through our RCGP Pride panel discussion on LGBT plus healthcare, we know that 33% of patients from the LGBT plus community felt their GP did not meet their needs, and 72% of practices could improve their LGBT plus services. In your practice, do you find yourself advocating for LGBT plus patients? And what has been your experience treating LGBT plus patients, being a member of the community yourself?
So as a practice, we did recognise that we had a significant LGBTQ community, and not only access to services, but we needed to make sure that all services were equitable for all aspects of our population. We did take the practice through the Pride in Practice education just to ensure that all practice colleagues, from front of house to admin to all clinical teams, felt confident in talking to people about their health and care needs, whatever their gender identity.
Well, for me, my career so far has only involved hospital medicine. I like to think that I would advocate for all patients in my practice and carry on that throughout my career. But I do think there is a layer of shared experience and understanding that everyone in part of the community has a sort of coming out story of sorts and has had to work through their own version of various different challenges that I'm sure we can all relate to. I think the particularly obvious challenge that I've seen is the case of transgender patients, where some members of the team, sort of the doctors, surgeons, wider members of the MDT, have not been sure or particularly comfortable with the use of pronouns, different names on their hospital records to the name that they would like to be known by. And in this case, I felt that my sort of role really was to just set an example and be really clear about the use of pronouns, the acceptable use of language, and sort of stamping out any untoward comments, which obviously was quite difficult. And as a foundation doctor, but someone has to make a start, so I thought, why not?
I think I'm in a similar sort of boat to Chloe as well. A lot of my practice so far has been hospital-based medicine, but moving forward into general practice over the next kind of 18 months or so, I would like to think that like all of us, with that we are advocating for all of our patients, but in particular for our LGBT plus patients, because like you said, we have a shared experience with them. We want to try and make sure that we're being the most kind of open, understanding, accessible practitioners that we can be, because I think from my own perspective, when I go to my GP, that's all I want, really. I want them to treat me with respect, I want them to understand, and I want them to be knowledgeable most of all. You know, I want them to understand what my rights are in terms of kind of, I think we'll talk about this a little bit later on, parental leave and adoption, what my rights are with regards to kind of fertility, and kind of what services there are locally that are specific to me as a queer woman. What can I access? What can they help me with? And I think that's what I would want to try and do for my own patients, is kind of advocate those services and just be really knowledgeable, really open and understanding.
Thank you for those observations. Do you feel like you have enough resources at this stage in your career? And you mentioned you would like to be advocates. What would help you to achieve that?
So I really like a quote that my friend Izzy, if she's listening, she'll know who she is, came up with to discuss what is needed in this situation. And the idea of being an ally means that you should listen twice as much as you talk. So really, I think it's a case of listening to the stories of people in the community. You know, I might be a queer woman, but I don't understand really the experience of a queer man or a transgender person. You know, those experiences are unique, and although I might have some common ground, I'm not sort of fully aware of those experiences. So it's about listening, first of all. I mean, I have had some experience in changing the curriculum at medical school, and we felt quite strongly, so again with this friend Lizzie, we felt quite strongly that things needed to be better integrated across the curriculum, so that we didn't just have a sort of 1 hour once in a 6 year course sort of crash course in how to deal with this community. That seemed like madness. So we set up a teaching session which runs for a full day, and it involves inviting members of the LGBT community who are not medical into the medical school, and really allowing students to gain a full understanding and really sort of develop empathy with these potential patients. And I think that was really powerful, and that was a resource that we came up with, but I think I'd really like to see that kind of integrated later on, so perhaps in foundation doctor training and maybe in future sort of specialty training as well. I think it's a really important reminder and should be sort of not a one-off thing in medical training.
So I think there's a couple of things, there's a couple of angles, isn't there? There's the support and services around gender identity services and the issues around that, and making sure that people have access to early assessments and treatment options. And then the other bit that I suppose my mind focuses to is the health inequalities, and particularly late presentation of disease or late access to treatment around screening options, and just late presentation of common diseases like high blood pressure, heart disease, lung disease and asthma. Actually, people are from the LGBT community, patients are underrepresented, and the prevalence of disease in that group actually needs to be increased. We need to identify people earlier. In terms of practices, I would just say that recognise your inequalities. They are there. And I am probably speaking out of turn, but I'm sure the LGBT Foundation would actually support you wherever you are. I can't speak for them, so maybe we check that before we put that out there. But I'm sure they're happy to support wherever your practice is. And I would actually just echo the bit about listening. I don't have a specialist interest particularly, other than I say my specialist interest is listening. So I kind of use teaching sessions and opportunities to just discuss the issues, because the more we're able to talk about it and understand what people are saying, the more likely we can be empathetic, we can help, and then maybe know where to go for resources. I do think that commissioning can be improved to address the inequalities and make sure that, you know, people and populations are, and access to care is the best it can be.
The second theme to discuss is women GPs at work. Early pioneers in medicine had to compromise their ambitions with societal realities and expectations. Today, over 50% of GPs are women and are afforded more work flexibility and opportunity in general practice. How did your journey into medicine and general practice look? And has your identity as a woman from the LGBT plus community ever influenced your training or career?
I think that my journey into medicine and kind of into GP as well has very much been influenced by being an LGBT plus woman. I think that one, it was probably influenced on the one hand that for a long time I thought I was going to do emergency medicine. I watched a lot of ER as a kid and thought it looked really cool and was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something dangerous and kind of exciting, and that's what my life is going to look like. But in reality, kind of the unsociable hours and the work constraints that go around that specialty were just so intense and just too much. And I think it came to the realization that just before going into training in that specialty, that actually that was not a sustainable career, and that was not something that I was going to be able to do long term, because I would reflect on the fact that actually I wanted to have that good work-life balance. I wanted to think about having kids in the future, and I was like, that for me, that wasn't sustainable. I was around a lot of amazing women that had managed to do that and looked up to them a lot and thought, great, you know, I wish I could do that, but kind of reflected and thought, I don't think I'm quite that kind of person. So kind of chose the GP route because I knew what kind of a flexibility, not only with kind of the work-life balance it would give me in the future, but with my own interest in LGBT plus healthcare as a queer woman, like how I could incorporate my own identity into my career.
I actually started my working life at KPMG, which is a sort of big four city accounting consultancy firm. Ended up sort of slowly drifting into the public sector and then realised I actually wanted to do clinical hands-on work. And so when I actually started my medical degree, I went to Lucy Cavendish College at Cambridge, which is for women over 21 who've all changed careers or maybe not had an alternative path and then they've switched or access education later in life. So it was a really interesting community of people who had all kinds of ideas. But the thing that was very sort of present there was, well, A, quite a feminist ideology. So there was no pressure to pick a certain career because I was a woman or to avoid certain careers because of being a woman. It was very much a go out there and go and do your thing, which was an amazing environment to be part of, especially in medical training and especially being just a couple of years older than the standard of age group. But I think my choice for GP has been influenced by a couple of things. So firstly, me sort of recognising the influence that being part of the LGBT community has had on me as a person. So I used to talk about being incidentally gay, and I used to talk about my other interests, so largely just the flute. But I used to say I'm lots of these different things. Oh, and by the way. And then I think as I sort of increased in confidence and had more serious relationships, I started to accept that actually it had really influenced the way that I see the world, the way that I interact with different organisations, and probably the way that I think about health inequalities too. And so like Martha said, you know, I really see GP as a way to see lots of different patients. And, you know, a huge amount of the sort of frontline healthcare does happen in GP. And also gives you an opportunity to understand what's going on at that kind of grassroots level and think about how best you can help patients from a sort of population point of view. So that's the things that really sort of are attractive. And then from a personal perspective as well, seeing the sort of Pride and Practice stuff, seeing the presence of the LCGP at Pride, all of those things are quite attractive. And to thinking about, you know, what kind of workforce do I want to join in the future, having tried some other career situations.
I think my career to date, I've not really defined it from my LGBT side, to be honest. I think the reason I chose general practice was around the intellectual curiosity of it. So I'm interested by anything that's in front of me, any problem, any issue, I'll try and figure out what's going on. So it's more of a curiosity, and I get bored quickly. So I could not be a specialist in left ventricular heart failure, or even worse, right ventricular heart failure. I mean, that would just be the most diabolical career I could ever think about, just dealing with that one thing. So I'm all for variety, spontaneity, curiosity. What's going to happen today? Actually, we've got no idea. What skills then can I rely on? Well, I can rely on the fact that I'll listen. I can rely on the fact that I'm a problem solver. And the thing that's taken me to various places is the fact that there's loads of opportunities in general practice. There's loads of great people everywhere in GP, in primary care networks, in hospital systems, in integrated systems. I think just, you know, people are fabulous. And actually general practice gives you stretch opportunities. So whatever you want to do, you can take your career in that general direction. So not being pigeonholed in terms of a specialist, I go with, you know, what's interested me at the time. And I've had some, you know, fabulous roles. I think I've done everything except prison medicine, but that's not on my hit list.
Ali, I'm curious about the makeup of your practice. The fact we do have over 50% women GPs now. Have you visibly seen that change during the span of your career?
So I think there's a couple of things in that. So speaking from my practice perspective, I mean, I'm really fortunate to work with great practice colleagues. We're 50% LGBT in our practice. We are underrepresented in women partners. So that for me is an issue. But actually, should it be an issue? We're working with people that share the same values and actually want to put patients first. So actually, is it an issue? I don't know on reflection. And we're diverse in terms of we've got South Asian colleagues as well. So I think we are unusual in the fact that we have a diverse practice. And I actually think that's a great strength for the population, therefore, that we serve. So the bit that I wanted to pick up on was I still think we've got an issue of part-time. I think there's still more work to do in supporting women to go for stretch career leadership opportunities. And I reflect on when I was in GP training, I worked with the training program team at the time to do an academic GP training job into the academic unit of primary care to do a bit of teaching. So we developed this innovative GP post as it was then. And the practice I was at that time said, "Oh, Ali, you're going part-time then." And I was like, "No, I'm doing another role in the time I'm not at the practice." So there is still this, that was a decade or more ago now. So it might not be as bad, but I do think part-time working does pose challenges for whoever wants to go part-time and actually ensure that actually you, if you want to consider family and portfolio, how you do fit it all in. So there are skills that we all need to develop to make sure that you look after yourself, you look after your family, and you do the roles that you want to do.
Do you think there's a conversation that could be had to change that stigma?
I just think we should welcome diversity, and we should welcome people to make a choice on how they want to organise their careers, because actually it's a long game, it's not a sprint, and your career can change over the years. So I've done less or more over the years depending on what's gone on. And actually what general practice does currently is allow that opportunity and allow that flexibility. And I do think we as a college do need to do a bit around the fact that the flexible workforce, you can choose how many sessions you do, actually is an asset. And the workforce figures do show that the headcount is increasing, but full-time hours is reducing. And this is seen as a really big issue. But actually, is it an issue? Can't we just understand what that means for the workforce and why that is happening, and actually make sure that we understand it and put opportunities in to support people to have a fulfilling, long career? Because we do know that retention is a problem. So actually giving people opportunity and diversity and portfolio options is a good thing in the long term.
Chloe and Martha, do you have any other thoughts on that point?
I think kind of anecdotally from within my kind of training cohort, I think a lot of my peers would be wanting to kind of go down that portfolio GP route and to have a much more flexible way of working in the future. So I think, like you said, it that part-time working is increasing, and I think it will only continue to increase, because when we're being when we kind of discuss career options, then portfolio GP is kind of a big bullet point on that list. You know, it's not just the traditional kind of salary GP or partner. You know, I think there's a lot more focus on trying to get what you want out of your career, and like you said, getting what you want out of it depending on what's going on in your personal life. So I think that trend will only continue into the future, and I think that a lot of my colleagues and perhaps people to come into GP training will pursue work balance then.
I used to run the GP Society at university, and one of our sort of big kind of campaigns was actually to really celebrate the diversity you could have with a career as GP. So a portfolio GP career was almost peddled as the sort of premium option. So it's almost the reverse of what you were saying, Ali, about it being seen as a lesser option. For a lot of people, that was a major reason for actually choosing GP, and certainly it's played into my decision making as well, because I'm quite interested in sort of academia, but I don't necessarily know if I want to be strict in that. And you know, I'm also quite interested in sort of other kind of inequalities work. So there's all kinds of stuff that I'm excited to do alongside the core of the clinical work, which I think would still make up the bulk of the career. But it's a really attractive part of the profession for lots of people.
That's really exciting to hear the change in perception in GP SOCs, and this leads us nicely into opportunities in general practice. The exhibition's leadership theme mentions general practice has over 50% more women GPs than men, but are largely underrepresented in leadership roles in the profession, referencing a lack of mentorship and role modelling. Considering your current career stage and being part of a minority community within an underrepresented section of the profession, how was your journey accessing leadership roles, or will it affect your confidence applying for them? And what do you hope to engender in that position of influence? And Ali, I would like to come to you first, as you are the soon-to-be demitting Northwest Faculty Chair. I think you've unintentionally made yourself a bit of a role model.
Yeah, and that kind of thing freaks me out a bit. But with the faculty and in all leadership roles, my approach is that I'm here to build opportunities. So my advice would be, if you want to do something, go for it and go and speak to people and go and ask about roles and opportunities. Don't let anything stop you having conversations, because that's how you go and find out what's going on. So please go for it. The things that I've tried to do from a faculty is build a more inclusive faculty, a faculty that welcomes new members, a faculty board that represents our membership a lot more. We've built the faculty board based now on specialist interests rather than the old geographical sub-faculty work that really doesn't represent how we think and about professions anymore, and that has really helped. With the team, we've got a really active BAME committee that I'm really proud about, because that's largely women who have put themselves forward to support their community and develop leadership roles, and hopefully through mentoring and giving them opportunities, they will then go on to the next levels. And we're quite keen as a faculty to again support Pride in Practice and to support Pride events going forward. And ultimately, I just want the college to be seen as a home, a place for all members. And whatever you represent, whatever your viewpoint, that is a place that you can go. So using the fact that I come from a diverse section of the population, so to speak, we welcome all, and that's the ethos that I've put into the faculty through my time as chair.
Thanks so much for those insights and that advice, Ali. Chloe, you mentioned previously you were heavily involved in leading your GP SOC. Do you feel like you're going in a certain trajectory there? and for yourself, Martha, as an AIT, possibly taking on an AIT rep position?
To be honest, I think the idea of running the GP Society with our homemade stickers and banners translating into any kind of leadership job is quite funny. I don't think it's probably very likely, but I really enjoyed doing it, and it gave me opportunity to meet lots of different people. I think I have had some really interesting experiences as a result of doing that. So Nish Manek, who I'm sure you've all heard of, runs the Next Generation GP sort of leadership programme. I was really lucky to be able to sort of go along as a student. I think I was in my fifth year at the time. I had nothing to contribute, but gained so much from hearing all of the speakers. And that was really, really interesting because there were lots of great role models, male, female, from sort of a whole range of different communities, including the LGBT community. And just getting the opportunity to see actually that a lot of their careers were very unique and they'd carved their own paths, but thinking about the fact that that option was available to everybody in the room and beyond was really, really powerful. So I don't think it needs to be a specifically LGBT space, but the idea of fostering sort of an environment where anything goes, as long as you're good and you turn up and you do the job, then that's really valued. The rest of you, I think, you know, it is in some ways less important than the role that you have to play, but I think does inform your role, because all of us have our own sort of biases from our experiences and something unique to bring to the table. So I think celebrating people bringing their whole selves to work is amazing, and needs to happen, and that's something that I sort of learned from Next Gen GP. It's about sort of finding a role, whether that's leadership, whether that's not leadership, but a role that allows you to be your full self. It is a really sort of important goal of mine. So I don't know what I'm going to end up doing because I'm an F2. But
I think that from my own perspective, I haven't really been involved in any kind of leadership applications or any roles so far in my career. I think that being obviously involved in this podcast and having been involved in the other panel as well that we did a few weeks ago, it's nice to meet other people kind of within kind of the context of LGBT plus health who have the same passion and kind of become role models and people that you look up to because of they are passionate in that area of healthcare and within kind of the GP sector as well. I really liked what you said, Chloe, about kind of everybody has something to contribute. I think that's really lovely because I think that I would love to be a leader, but then I think my own confidence kind of squishes that a little bit a lot of the time. And I think because I want to be a leader and I want to be there to advocate for my patients and for mainly for the LGBT plus community. But sometimes I worry that, you know, I don't want to take up space for somebody else who deserves to be there a bit more, you know. And I know that sounds a bit strange, but, you know, I'm very aware of my own privilege as a white, cis, able-bodied woman, and I want to lift up my other kind of members of the community and make sure that they have a platform to work on, and kind of the underrepresented people within the community are able to kind of speak up and be represented. But I know that in order to do that sometimes, then I would have to be a leader myself. So I think I'm trying to find that balance, and that's kind of a bit of a reflective journey that I'm on at the moment. And hopefully we'll get to be a leader in the future.
I mean, leadership kind of, you don't have to have a role. It's clear that Chloe and Martha, you are leaders in your own right, and you are displaying quite strong and enviable and humbling leadership skills. So don't please use what you've done already positively, and don't let anything hold you back. Like you said, anything goes, and general practice is a career where you can, you know, take it wherever you want. So please go for it. And I think That's something about leadership, isn't it? We see it as exclusive, but actually we all need to have those skills, because even advocating for patients, we have to show leadership, and advocating for a population, we have to show leadership, and even saying no and saying when, you know, speaking out when something is wrong, Chloe, which you've done admirably, is leadership. So leadership is for all, and it shouldn't be harder or easier for anybody. And I think you guys are showing that in abundance already.
Thanks so much for saying that, Ali. I couldn't agree more with you. One of the last themes we will discuss as part of this conversation is the family unit. The exhibition talks about early women doctors remaining unmarried and without children, but cohabiting and sharing a, quote, common life with lifetime friends who were also women. This was during the Victorian and Edwardian period, and although we can't apply modern terminology or assumptions on these historical figures, their lifestyle would certainly have appeared odd, in apostrophes, at the time, since they were women practicing medicine and not adhering to gender or familial expectations. I'm curious, what are your reflections on this, considering the modern family unit no longer has to conform to the traditional 2.4 children and a cis heterosexual couple?
I'll have a go. So we have a family. We've adopted two very special young people who I don't think without them, I actually think they give me quite a lot inner strength, because they wouldn't tolerate being nervous or not going for something. So the power that my family give me is quite significant, and I still think there's a bit of work to do on, I'm going to use a really bad term, allowing, which is wrong, isn't it? In supporting the opportunities for a family unit for all, however you see it, however you want to achieve it. And I do think there is still a bit of hesitancy on going for it. You know, without my family, I don't believe I would be the same person. So I would see it as if it's for you, I think you need to go for it. But there may be still attitudes that need to change to recognise that there is a diversity in family units still.
Yeah, so I have thoughts about it. I think being maybe slightly younger than the others has given me a slightly different perspective. So I suppose I sort of see it as just completely normal and acceptable that I would have a family. And I realised how privileged that makes me relative to other sort of generations and people who've gone before me. But yeah, it's always been on my agenda. Not yet, definitely not yet, just to clarify. But maybe in the next, I don't know, hopefully within the next sort of decade or so. I think my views on this are actually really very simple. I think a family comes in all shapes and sizes. You know, I grew up with people who had one parent of either gender. I grew up with people who, you know, their parents were both single, fell in love, they ended up being friends and also stepsisters, you know, all kinds of diversity. I've got friends from school who are sort of devout Muslim, who've had arranged marriages. I've got friends who are in polyamorous relationships. And actually, all that matters fundamentally is that you're doing A, what's right for you, you're treating people well. You know, it's not a new thing. There have always been a wide variety of families, but I think maybe what feels new is the public nature of it. So I doubt many other people listening to this podcast are following these people on the internet, but there's lots of examples of sort of influencers on Instagram and YouTube who are just displaying what sort of LGBT or rainbow family could look like. But I've been watching these, so Rose and Rosie and Jessica and Claudia, names that people may recognise. I've been watching these people on YouTube since I was a teenager, and now they have kids, or a kid. And that's wild, but also that's just normal because I've seen it modelled. So that's really powerful. I don't think there's anything weird about sort of wanting a child and loving it.
No, absolutely. I would completely agree. Like, it's something that I think my partner and I would want in the future, and it's something we think about and think about what our options are kind of in the future. Like, how would we do it? You know, what would our family unit look like? And I think that's a real privilege as a member of the LGBT plus community, is that we kind of get to help, you know, redefine society's idea of what a family unit looks like, on top of kind of all the different varieties that there are amongst kind of straight couples. We get to kind of define our family unit for ourselves, and I think that's really special. And you know, if you want to do it, like you said, go for it, and I think that's fantastic.
Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on that theme, which can be a sensitive subject for women to discuss regardless due to related stigma around age, health, career, financials or societal. The last topic I'd like to talk about, which we touched on earlier, obviously this episode is titled LGBT plus women in general practice, and we would love to have had a representative voice from one of our trans women colleagues, as we don't want to speak on their behalf. I wonder what your thoughts are on supporting and championing our trans women colleagues and patients. And Chloe, if I could come to you first, maybe we could talk about some of the findings from your LGBT plus session at your med school.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're sort of currently writing up a paper actually based on the responses we got from a post-session survey over a couple of years. And the thing that really stood out for me as part of that was that people were, A, very honest in the comments, and they were saying things like, I've never met a trans person, I've never spoken to someone from this community, I would never have normally crossed paths with them, and I had so much to learn. So I think there is an appetite out there. You have to believe that most people are interested and want to be helpful as a starting point. I do think most people, you know, nobody's sort of born with a sense of stigma that comes as a result of kind of social conditioning. And most people fundamentally want to learn more and support people. That's why we're all doctors, really. So I do think that was really encouraging and also quite moving as well. But in terms of actually making that into something tangible that you can use in practice, I think that becomes slightly more difficult because it's, you know, part of it is building the trust of the trans community. I think a lot of damage has been done to that community through, you know, sort of minority stress and other kind of impacts of maybe over-medicalisation. There's obviously lots of stuff in the news, there's lots of noise around the transgender population. I think it's really important to acknowledge that and to also note that, you know, it's pretty exhausting to be that person who constantly represents your community as an individual. And I think so recognising that and also building up the trust that we've got more people who are happy to publicly advocate for being trans. Because, you know, it's a lot to ask of sort of one or two people. You need to have that network, but that will take time. So I think it's our role, actually, as people who, you know, I often get told, oh, I don't look gay, or, you know, I can't believe you're gay, or that's such a shock. That gives me a sense of privilege in that no one's assuming anything about my sexuality or about my gender identity. And that means that I can more easily navigate these social spaces. And I think for the trans population, we need to make it safe enough that it's okay to disclose should they want to, but they don't have to. So I think it's a really complicated issue. But I think we're certainly aware of the fact that, you know, this call has been three white cis women who happen to be LGBT. And I suppose that's partly because we're the people who felt safe enough to talk about this on the internet without sort of fear of significant backlash. But in order to create a situation where everybody feels safe enough to do that, there is some work to do. And I think it's important to just be honest about that.
The fact that we don't have a trans colleague here is speaks volumes. So I can't put it any better than you have, Chloe, to be honest. I do think there's work to do to support, you know, the health needs, the population health needs, the inequalities, and actually for just to be more open, welcoming and understanding at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I would completely agree with you both. And like we've mentioned a couple of times already, I think one massive part of being an advocate is listening. And that's such a big part of our role as GPs as well.
Thank you, Martha. And I know you spoke in depth on the subject of trans care and support in the RCGP Pride panel discussion, which will be linked in this episode's description. I'm going to bring this episode to a close. So thank you so much, Martha, Ali and Chloe, for joining me for this episode of Team GP Perspectives. And thanks to you, the listener, for joining. Check out the full Women at the Heart of General Practice exhibition online and our RCGP Pride Season activities and events also online. A reminder that today's speakers have volunteered their own perspectives, and if you would like to be involved in an episode or suggest a perspective, get in touch with the Membership Communities team.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for having us all. I think it's really encouraging that all of these discussions are happening in a professional space, you know, rather than just sort of having a rant at the pub. You know, this is an amazing opportunity to really talk about some of the thornier issues that maybe don't come up in a sort of everyday clinical setting, but they're always there in the background. So thanks very much for giving us a chance to talk about it.